All right, we have one case on our 10:30 docket, Neighbors versus Ancona Oil. If the clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Hurst to argue for the appellant and Mr. David Johnson to argue for the appellee.
All right, and before we get started, I wanted to advise counsel of a couple of housekeeping matters. This court will be granting the motion to strike the exhibits to the amicus brief, those exhibits that were not before the trial court. We are denying the motion to strike the amicus brief, and we are granting leave to file appellee's response to the amicus brief, just so you all are aware of all that. All right, if we can begin now, we'll call Michael Hurst for appellant.
Very much, and may it please the court, counsel. The issue in this appeal boils down to whether section 14.8 of the form day work contract between Neighbors and Ancona requires Neighbors to indemnify Ancona for contractual liabilities that Ancona incurred with its other contractors, in this case Weatherford and Fowler. And no matter how Ancona tries to argue around the issue, the answer always comes up no. In fact, Ancona specifically admits in its briefing on pages 18 and 19 of its response that Neighbors never agreed to indemnify Weatherford and Fowler. So what Ancona has tried to argue and was able to somehow persuade the trial court is that, yes, Neighbors, you don't have to indemnify Weatherford or Fowler for their negligence, but we have this issue because we and Ancona entered into these master service agreements with Weatherford and Fowler, and we owe Weatherford and Fowler indemnity for their own negligence, and therefore we're going to put that on you. The problem is, and why that comes out to an absurd result, is that is not at all what Neighbors agreed to do in the form day work contract. In section 14.8 of the form day work contract, Neighbors agreed to indemnify Ancona for any claims, liabilities, causes of action in favor of Neighbors' employees arising out of bodily or account of bodily injury. That's it. That's all they agreed to do in this contract. It's different from the other contracts where they agreed to indemnify contractors, the operators' contractors or subcontractors or invitees. So what we're looking at is the in favor of language. What does that mean? And that means under any definition, under any use in the history of Texas jurisprudence and Texas legislative history, in favor of is who owns the claims and who has standing to assert those claims. What it doesn't mean is what is the indemnity is not triggered as a result of a claim against Ancona just because it happens to be a Neighbor's employee that is injured. What it means is that Neighbors has to indemnify Ancona for claims that are in favor of Neighbors' employees against Ancona. In other words, did Neighbors' employees assert claims against Ancona? In this case, they did at one point in time. The Neighbors' employees asserted claims against Ancona. Clearly, Neighbors owed indemnity to Ancona for those claims that were asserted, and Neighbors did, in fact, pay that indemnity. But what the overreaching part is what Ancona has tried to do at the trial court level, and that is to say, well, you also have to indemnify us for our contractual liabilities, which you weren't even a party to, these other master services agreements with Fowler and Weatherford, and you have to pay us back for those. Now, that's just not what the contract says. It doesn't matter who is injured. What matters pursuant to this contract and based upon all the commentators that both sides have cited, including this man Pugh, is what has mattered is not who is injured, but who is making the claim. Ancona knows very good and well if it really wanted to make sure that they got the result that they're trying to get now, they would have had to negotiate specific language with Neighbors that contractors and subcontractors and invitees would have had to been included in the indemnity. How do we know that Encana knows this language besides it's a big, sophisticated operator? We know it because in the master service agreements with Weatherford and Fowler that are part of the record that were entered into a long time before the day work contract was entered into between Neighbors and Encana, that language specifically shows that Encana agreed to indemnify Weatherford and Fowler and all of its other contractors, subcontractors, their employees, invitees, and agents. That language is absolutely and noticeably missing from the day work contract between Neighbors and Encana. So this court respectfully should consider the question of whether the master service agreement created any obligations in favor of Neighbors' employees, that is the master service agreements between Encana and Weatherford and Encana and Fowler. And the answer is absolutely not. And the only claims in this case, and I think this is where the issues, they try to confuse the issues, the only claims in this case are not by a Neighbor's employee, because that, those claims have been resolved. The claims in this case for which Encana is seeking reimbursement and seeking indemnity are contractual claims between Weatherford and Fowler on the one hand and Encana on the other. So every single case, every single statute that's used the phrase in favor of has a meaning of standing or ownership. They cite to nothing that changes the meaning of that of that in favor of. Nothing other than, save and except, they make a vague reference to the free online dictionary.com to somehow alter that meaning. On the other hand, we've done a global search, and I suspect both sides have done a global search of all cases in the country that specifically define in favor of. One case comes out, it happens to be a case out of the District of Montana from last year, and that case, and it actually, and it had a 14.8 clause, a day work contract as well, and that case was, which is the Liberty Mutual Insurance versus Continental Resources, held that indemnification language that requires that the claim rise in favor of an employee of the contractor did not extend to survivors' claims for emotional distress and loss of consortium. In other words, the court says in favor of language does not require the contractor to indemnify third parties, but rather limits the claims to in favor of the contractor's employees. So the only case it directly defines in favor of, as opposed to the common usage, is this District of Montana case. Of course, hundreds of cases in Texas and many, many statutes that have all been cited in the brief reference in favor of, and they talk about in favor of as meaning ownership, or use it in the sentence as being ownership and standing of. I'd also submit to your honors that there is absolutely zero cases that support their position out there that an IADC contract that's not been modified, that includes the language, the form contract that uses the language that's the subject of this appeal here, not one case where they found that indemnity had to go pass through indemnity to third parties. Not one. They cite a handful of cases that do require pass-through indemnity, and every single one of those cases has the modified language of saying that the contractors of the operator, as well as the subcontractors and invitees, are indemnified. There's no cases to the contrary, and that in and of itself shows why. Now, they do cite this, and let's talk about this IADC form day work contract. They cite to apparently the legal scholar in the country, because we both cite to him. His name is Pew, and they cite in the very article that we cite to the fact that contracts can be indemnified by the through the IADC form work, but it still has to be in favor of a neighbor's employee. So if the neighbor's employee asserts a contract claim directly against Encana, Neighbors would have been required to indemnify based upon that claim. But that's not what we have here, and that's their attempt to confuse the issue, because they leave out the rest of the statement of that article, the very article by this guy Pew, where it says, absent express language, an indemnity provision will not be held to cover indemnity's contractual liability to a third party. That is exactly the very issue that we have here today. Now, Encana goes through this ruse, if you will. Instead of reimbursing Fowler and Weatherford for their contractual liability for Fowler and Weatherford's settlement of their claims with the two neighbors' employees, plaintiffs, the Mullins and Newsom. They say, well, hey, Feller and Weatherford, don't worry about it. We'll go pay them directly. Now, this was a calculated decision they wanted to make to try to show somehow, well, look, we paid the neighbors' employees directly for the contractual liability we owed to Fowler and Weatherford. Therefore, we kind of skipped over Fowler and Weatherford, and this is really a claim between neighbors, employees, and Encana. But all you have to do is look to the very nature of the claims that they're trying to get reimbursement and indemnity for. And the very nature of those claims are contractual indemnity, contractual liability claims between Fowler and Weatherford on the one hand and Encana on the others. It has nothing to do with neighbors. So the other provisions they try to argue, let me point out a couple things. First of all, they try to say that 14.9, we point out if the language of in favor of somehow means related to instead of that party owns or has standing to assert the claim, which would be, again, contrary to every statute and jurisprudence in the state, if not the country. But if that is really what the definition is, then all you have to do is look to 14.9, where it goes back the other way, and they would end up having to indemnify us, or it would either be in conflict or it would create circular indemnity. It doesn't make sense. You'd have to harmonize 14.8 and 14.9 to the plain meaning, which is that in favor of means that in 14.8, we agreed to indemnify Encana when a neighbor's employees assert claims against Encana directly, and the vice versa is in 14.9 with Encana. However, if they try to argue that it's broader, that in favor of means that it involves all claims, then that means that any claim that would have been asserted against neighbors' contractors, other contractors, would necessarily have to be indemnified by Encana. So the indemnity would come back the other way. 14.9 says from and against all claims, operator has to indemnify contractor from and against all claims, demands, liabilities, and causes of action of every kind and character in favor of operators' employees or operators' contractors or their employees. So they try to get around this idea that these provisions would be in conflict using their definition by coming up with adding another meaning and another definition to 14.9, even though it doesn't say it. They try to say, well, that only applies to Encana's employees, even though the plain language says it applies to their contractors and employees and everybody else. They have to make an argument that 14.9 doesn't really mean what it says, because otherwise it would be in conflict or would create circular indemnity if in favor of means anything other than the party owns the claim or has standing to assert the claim. The other argument that Encana tries to make is that 14.13 just opens up everything. Despite the limitations of 14.8, they try to say, well, but then you have 14.13, and 14.13 says that everything is covered and you have to indemnify us for everything else, which is kind of the Mother Hubbard of clauses. What they ignore by making this argument is two things. One is they ignore that 14.13, the preamble sentence says, except as otherwise expressly limited herein. So what does that mean? That, of course, means that the limitations of 14.8 control as being more specific over the general statements in 14.13. You also could look to the preamble to the entire day work contract, which says contractor assumes only the obligations and liabilities stated herein. So that in and of itself would indicate that you go to 14.13 doesn't overrule, if you will, 14.8 in the contract. But then just to button it all up, there's another case that's directly on point in this issue, and it's a recent case out of Houston, and it's called Sanera. Sanera Resource versus Helmerich out of the First District Court of Appeals, and it was actually this year, where it says that 14.13, the opening phrase in paragraph 14.13 does not expand 14-8's limited indemnity scheme. So that's all. I mean, you have all of the provisions, all of the case law specifically, and that support that in favor of is only for the benefit of Nabors employees against Encana. It doesn't somehow drag in this pass-through liability. Assuming that somehow, some way, somewhere, it comes out that this court would believe, and again, I suggest the trial court is completely on an island on this. There's no case in the entire country that supports the position that the trial court gave with respect to indemnity to Encana's contractual indemnities, which Encana admits would not otherwise be would not be paid. But if somehow this court comes to the decision that is the intent and that was the expectation, the express negligence rule would certainly preclude them from recovering from us on something unless it's specifically spelled out. As this court is well aware, the Texas Supreme Court in 1987 came out with the Ethel case. The Ethel case says if somebody's going to be responsible for their own negligence, or somebody has to indemnify somebody else for their own negligence, that has to be expressly spelled out. And it's expressly spelled out perhaps as to Encana for its negligence, but what it's not spelled out to is Encana's contractors. And it would have to be spelled out as to Weatherford and Fowler. There are numerous cases that address this issue, including two Fifth Circuit cases that we've cited in our brief. One was the Exxon case, and the other is the Corbett case from the 1980s that says that the express negligence clause applies to pass-through indemnity and that has to specifically be spelled out. I see that my time is up, and I'm happy to come back to visit with you at rebuttal. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hurst. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court. Mr. Hurst, the trial court properly granted summary judgment for Encana because the party's contract included contractual liabilities arising from injuries to Nabors employees. This is because the contract contained general language that included any and all claims without limit, no matter what the cause. It also contained very specific language that included contractual liabilities. Because the contract's language is so clear, Nabors has had to come up with some red herring arguments to try to get around that language. And principally, they argue about industry customs and cite to other MSAs and other contracts and their beliefs. But there's no evidence in the record to support those arguments. Actually, the case law that we've cited in our brief is exactly on point and talks about the very purpose of these reciprocal indemnity agreements, what the industry calls knock-for-knock agreements. And that is that the triggering event for liability is the injury to an employee. And all liability goes to the employee's employer. So you don't have to worry about who caused what, and you don't have to have litigation between contractor and operator or between contractors. The basis of that is the industry just felt like it was a more it was a quicker and more fair result to do it that way, because on one drill site, my employee is going to be injured and I've got to compensate them, but the next time out, it's going to be someone else's and I get indemnified. So the trial court's judgment in this case is completely consistent with all of the precedent, both here in Texas and in the Fifth Circuit, dealing with the overall purpose of these knock-for-knock provisions. Getting to the actual construction of the language here and why the trial court was correct. First of all, Fifth Circuit case law is only some help, because the contract here is resolved under Texas law, and that's a very specific provision in the party's agreement. Under Texas law, the normal rules of contract construction apply and to interpret a indemnity agreement, and the court should look to the objective intent of the parties in the four corners of the document. It shouldn't stray to other documents or other extraneous evidence to glean some sort of subjective intent. The court should use the plain, common, ordinary terms, meaning of terms, and should read these provisions in harmony. Finally, the court should not interpret the language to include a qualifying phrase or a limitation that is not expressly set forth. Here, the party's language... relevant party's language is from 14.8, and it states that neighbors shall release and shall indemnify in canna from and against all claims, demands, liabilities, and causes of action of every kind and character without limit and without regard to the cause or causes thereof, arising in connection herewith in favor of a neighbor's employee on account of bodily injury, death, or damage to property. So the type of claim that is subsumed in this is very, very broad. It includes all claims and all liabilities. That includes tort, that includes contract, that includes everything. Now, what they have done is they have tried to limit this. And that, of course, they try to limit it by saying that it doesn't include contractual liability. It doesn't include contractual liability to third parties. First of all, there was no...
I haven't said it doesn't include contractual liability. It just doesn't include contractual liability of third parties, correct?
I think, from my reading of their argument, is it doesn't include contractual liability.
Well, as he just stood up here a few moments ago, he said that if one of neighbor's employees asserted contractual liability against Encana, I may have these parties, but if it was a neighbor's employee asserting contractual liability, that it would be different than a third party.
That's the first time they've made that statement in this case. If that's what they've said now, then they've at least conceded that much. But historically, they've said it doesn't cover contractual liability, and now they're saying it doesn't. I guess apparently now they're saying that contractual liability is to third parties. And, of course, that would be an implied restriction that isn't expressed in this document in any way. And we cite the court to the Oxy USA versus Southwestern case, which is in our briefing at 161 Southwest 3rd 22277. That case is whether a intentional tort claim fell within a broad indemnity provision. And the indemnity provision didn't say it covered intentional torts, but the party said because it didn't, it failed and it wasn't included within the scope of the indemnity provision. The Court of Appeals said no, it's broad enough to include them and it's not excluded and we're not going to imply this restriction. But you don't have to just rely on 14.8. You can also look in this document to 14.13, and it broadly provides that all indemnity obligations under the terms of this contract be without limit and without regard to the cause or causes thereof, including breach of contract. It expressly says that.
What about the preamble to that section? I mean, doesn't it then impose the limitations of 14.8?
No, it doesn't. Well, it does. But there is no limitation. They're saying that this is somehow making it broader than 14.8. 14.8 is as broad as it gets, and 14.13 is just going along with it and expanding upon, not expanding upon, but clarifying what is in 14.8. And the case they cite to, the Helmrick opinion on that issue, doesn't say what they said it says. Under the Helmrick opinion, under paragraph 11, the issue is whether 14.13 could be used to broaden 14.7, a different paragraph, not 14.8. 14.7 was a very specific indemnity dealing with materials that are being provided by a party. And so the issue there was whether 14.7 or 14.8 controlled in the case, okay? The court said you couldn't use 14.13 to expand 14.17. What's interesting is in the case there was this issue. Was 14.7 the controlling provision, or was it 14.8? And one of the parties said, well, 14.8 is a very narrow provision that only deals with employee injury claims, right? This whole kind of standing argument, this thing in favor of, only means that the employee has to bring the claim. Well, that was raised in the Sonora case that they've cited. And what does the court say about that? The court says Article 14.8 applies to a broad class of persons and a broad class of losses, and found that 14.8 was a very broad provision. And because it was broad, 14.7 controlled in that case. So when opposing counsel says there's no case out there that says in favor of means something other than having expressed standing or owning the claim, that's not true. Sonera case.
Does Sonera say it that it can be a claim by someone who doesn't have standing to bring the claim, such as what we have here?
It doesn't say that expressly, but it's.
It says it's broad.
It says it's broad, and it says it applies to a lot of different persons and a lot of different claims. What we do have is the Summerall opinion from the Fifth Circuit. That is 291 South F3rd at 316, once again cited in our briefs. And here, this exact argument is made. The exact argument, it deals with contractual liability of third parties and whether it goes to, you know, the employer of the employee. And the party there made the exact same argument that no, that the contractor contended that it owes indemnification for only those obligations flowing from actions filed directly against the operator by the contractor or the contractor's employees. So it made the exact same argument they just made. And what does the court say? It calls that an unusually poor argument and says it is specious.
Is that applying Texas law?
No, it's maritime law. So the court in ENSCO, so we have two cases now, one from the Fifth Circuit, one from Texas, saying that this language, this in favor of language, and this provision is very broad and would include many parties and many different claims.
I have a question. So the purpose of all of this is the parties enter into all these agreements and all these contracts, they get them all signed up, then presumably they go out and get the appropriate insurance to cover their exposure. Did the insurance policies at play come in any regard as to what type of insurance was purchased by each party?
Well, the record doesn't indicate when insurance policies were purchased, but the agreement under 14, paragraph 1413. I'm sorry, paragraph 13 provides for insurance.
Okay.
And it says that they have an obligation to purchase insurance to cover all their indemnity obligations. See Exhibit A, right? If you turn to Exhibit A, it says what is their obligations. Their obligations is to purchase a general liability insurance, including contractual obligations. So they were specifically supposed to buy insurance that provided for contractual liabilities. Now, if they didn't, they breached the contract. But that gets back to kind of our canon of construction, which is you have to read all these things together, right? You have to read paragraph 13 saying you have to buy insurance and it has to cover contractual liabilities. You have to read 14.8, which says they're indemnifying us for any and all liabilities, tort, contract, statutory, you name it, they have to cover it. And also paragraph 14.13 that says, oh, by the way, that also includes contractual liability. Now, what they have tried to do is limit it in two ways. One is, once again, this in favor of language saying that, no, it has to be the employee bringing the claim. It can't be someone else. Well, we have two cases that say that's not true. The other way they try to limit it is by this on account of bodily injury, saying, well, it's a contract claim. It's not a bodily injury claim. But what they have done is they have misconstrued this provision. If, as you can see, on account of bodily injury is at the very end of this sentence. They're using it to try to modify claims and liabilities up in the middle to the upper part of the sentence. There's a rule of construction that is the prior, the doctrine of last antecedent that states a qualifying phrase must be confined to the words or phrases immediately preceding it. And that's Spradlin versus Jim Walter Holmes, 34 Southwest 3rd, 578, Tex 2000. So what on account of bodily injury is talking about is the type of injury to the employee or the contractor's employee, okay? So does it arise out of that? If it does, it doesn't matter if it's a contract claim or a tort claim or whatever it is. It doesn't matter if it comes from them or if it comes from someone else. So, and I would once again refer the court to the Summerall case, the Fifth Circuit case, because it has the exact same placement of bodily injury in that clause, in that case. And the court said there that, no, it includes contractual liabilities to third parties.
They also say that there's no pass-through indemnification responsibility because the subs and contractors weren't included in this contract, as you did include them in the master service agreement. What's your response to that argument?
Okay, first of all, the court shouldn't look at the master services agreement because it's outside the four corners of this document. This document doesn't refer to it in any way. This court's confined to looking at the language in this document, first of all.
Right.
Second of all, there are two ways to provide us indemnity protection. One is to make these contractors third-party beneficiaries. And then it's really not indemnifying us. You're indemnifying the third-party contractors. They have standing to come and sue neighbors. Fowler & Weatherford could sue neighbors for indemnity. That's not, we weren't concerned with them with regard to indemnity. We're concerned about ourselves. There's a different way to protect us, and that is to expand the scope of the clause to include contractual liabilities. That's what we did. You don't have to do both. You don't have to do what they wanted to do. We can do it the way we wanted to do it, which is just to include the scope. Now, why is that a difference? Well, there's a difference because all we have to do is ask them to pay for what we were obligated to pay for our contractual liabilities. We paid $2 million to these individuals who were injured, the neighbors' employees who were injured. We paid them $2 million to resolve their claims, okay? Ultimately, they were paid $9 million. If Fowler had wanted to sue them directly for $9 million, that would have been a true pass-through liability. That would have been suing them if they were parties to this agreement. We're not asking for that. We're not asking for $9 million. We're only asking for our contractual liability, our $2 million that we're out of pocket. That's what we contracted for. That's what we were concerned about. So to answer your question, it's irrelevant that we didn't include contractors, subcontractors, and specifically name Fowler & Weatherford in this document, because the contractual provision is broad enough to include contractual liabilities to third parties. The circular indemnity argument is also specious because what they have done is they've once again confused this bodily injury claim modifier. The bodily injury modifier, once again, goes to the injury. They're saying, well, if it's our contractors we're paying money to, wouldn't we then be obligated to indemnify them under 14.9? Well, no, because our contractors don't have a bodily injury, right? Only their employee has a bodily injury. So it's picked up under 14.8, not 14.9. These are reciprocal indemnity agreements. They're mutually exclusive. And if you look at the language of 14.9, it expressly says that. 14.9 says, in favor of certain contractors, other than parties identified in subparagraph 14.8. So if there's an injury to one of their employees, it doesn't come under 14. May I finish my statement?
Yes.
It doesn't come under 14.9. And the fact that it's also in favor of a contractor is irrelevant because it's not a bodily injury claim. So they're not mutually exclusive. Your Honors, we'd ask that this court affirm the trial court's judgment because this document does include and is broad enough within its scope to include contractual liabilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Hurst, rebuttal.
First, like to address the Summerall versus Insco case, the 2002 Fifth Circuit case, which I think counsel does say applied maritime law, which I think is telling in and of itself. But the one thing that I think you need to focus on if you're going to read that Insco case is the very language in that Insco case. The primary reason Insco held what it, the Insco court held what it held, was that the Fifth Circuit noted that the special words invents an intention to create a right of indemnity for independent contractual liabilities. That contract specifically said, agreed to indemnify the operator and its contractors and subcontractors and their employees. That's what the Insco case says. That's what all of their cases have that we could hold in any way that there's pass-through indemnity. There are no cases whatsoever that support their contention that pass-through indemnity for third parties comes about with the day work language and the form contract that we have in 14.8. On the contrary, we have the Montana case that specifically holds otherwise, which says, as Liberty argues, the contract does appear to contain language that limits the policy's reach. Paragraph 14.8, as noted, provides that the contractor shall protect, defend, and indemnify the operator from and against all claims and causes of action arising in connection herewith in favor of contractors, employees on account of bodily injury, death, or damage to property. It says this language does not require the contractor to indemnify the operator against independent claims of third parties, but rather limits the obligation to claims arising in favor of contractors, employees. That's the language. They say this is very broad language. What they admit, and I think what we would all agree to, is that's not as broad as it gets. The broad language and what they should have had, the language in there, because they do talk about what the purpose behind these kinds of contracts and what have you, what they could have added is after joint owners in their chart over there, if you could look on the third line, they could have had PREN and other contractors and subcontractors. That's what's in their cases that they cite. And then they could have, after herewith, it wouldn't have had in favor of neighbors' employees. Instead of, it would have said on account of bodily injury, death, or damage to property to contractors' employees. That's what the other cases say. That's the situation where the indemnity would go through pass-through. And I think it's important to talk about, just because they bring up the issue of why this makes sense and why these indemnities operate the way they do. The IADC form land contract. The land contract is more spelled out in the amicus brief, but the land contract has where the contractor essentially works for the operator. The operator gets to pick all of the contractors out there, and the drilling contractor is just one of the contractors. The drilling contractor doesn't contract with the other contractors, doesn't supervise the other contractors. That's the operator. So it only makes sense that neighbors, the contractor, be responsible for its own employees. Offshore cases like the Ensco case are a little bit different because then you're on a big drilling rig. And when you're on a big offshore drilling rig, then the drilling contractor does, in a sense, operate and oversee the drilling operations, which is why the cases they cite are a little bit different, including this maritime situation. I see that I am about to run out of time right now.
Before you sit down, I have one last question, and that is, can you tell me specifically what relief you are requesting?
Thank you. We're asking, and thank you. I was about to do that. We asked that the Court of Appeals reverse and render as to the pass-through indemnity claims that are being cited here, and to remand on the what we call the pretender claims with respect to attorney's fees for further proceeding in the trial court.
I noticed in your brief you asked that this court reverse the trial court's overrulings of your objections to the parole evidence that neighbors submitted. Are you still asking for that?
Yes, we are, but we don't think we don't think the parole evidence is necessary, so we don't know that you necessarily need to do that to come to the conclusion of we think the unambiguous meaning of what in favor of means.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst, Mr. Johnson, and other counsel here today. We appreciate you being here. We also appreciate your arguments and all your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and you are excused. We will adjourn court.
All rise.